Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I am Donald Feltham, and I am thrilled to welcome back Melissa Errico. Welcome, Melissa.
Hello, my friend.
And she's here because she's got a brand new album. Sondheim in the City is now out on Concord Theatrical Recordings. And it is a terrific album, of course. Congratulations on a fantastic album. It is available on CD and digital at the same time, which is one of those rarities. We're thrilled that it's out on both formats.
May 7th, there'll be a vinyl.
Oh, I didn't know that. So that's good also. And we were talking before we started recording. Melissa and I were already charging into the album.
Meetings of life.
Yes. This is the second Sondheim album that you've done. You did one back in 2018 called Sondheim Sublime. So let's continue the conversation we were having, which was the reason.
Dare I say, by the way, which I didn't say earlier, just to throw a new thought there. It's going to be one of three.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's interesting.
I think I have a box set in my mind.
Ah, okay. Yeah,
the third one I tentatively have titled Consequences.
Ah, oh, I like that. I like
and
that one.
Yeah, super close up, also by Brigitte Lacombe, the great famous photographer who's done all the covers. Mm-hmm. Just a super close up on the eye.
Ah, oh, I like that idea. Okay.
Now I'm looking, you know, in profile at the wonders and threats and challenges of the energy, the vibrations of Manhattan. That's this record, Sondheim in the City. And the other one was a strong face forward, looking for the meaning of life through Sondheim Sublime. So I have this vision of these three covers as well.
Oh, cool. But well, and that kind of segues into like what my first bullet point on my notes, which was one of the reasons I think your albums work so well is that you're the kind of artist who, when you set out to make a recording, you're not somebody who just says, oh, look at the calendar. It's time for me to get back in the studio and do a recording. Let me gather up my favorite songs and we'll go and do an album. There's always an inspiration or a motivation for you behind every album. And you put so much thought and heart into every project that that's why they come out so accomplished and complex. And they are also different. I mean, this is vastly different than Out of the Dark, the last album, which was the exploration of film noir. And this one, is even vastly different than the last Sondheim album, because the last, as you were mentioning, what was the motivation for the last Sondheim album? There was something going on in your life that was really driving that.
Yeah, I mean, I was, I was in my 40s and, just sort of beginning my real maturity. I had three small children at home and I could really feel the pull, the philosophical pull in a song like Children and Art. I was kind of living Children and Art. And then the issues that kind of come up in Sondheim's work in Into the Woods about parenting and what lives on, the stories we tell our children. And then wouldn't you know it, I got a tumor in my body. It was a health problem that I have under control. It was a carcinoid. It's not cancer, but it was not a good thing. Mm-hmm. And I had a tumor in my body. I was working with Sondheim on another musical, just finished Do I Hear a Waltz. And then I was asked to do a concert at 54 Below with no notice. It was somebody canceled. And Jennifer Tepper said, could you just do something quickly? And as I was experiencing this terribly vulnerable moment with little kids and my body, I thought, well, I'll just do Sondheim. Because for me, like Sondheim was like easy because it was able to contain everything as it wasn't, we didn't feel phony. I certainly would feel phony if I sang like, just an Irving Berlin night or something, just my favorite love songs. So I did a Sondheim concert, which was extremely successful, and it got me thinking about what I was going through and how Sondheim can be a source of wisdom and courage in his writing itself. So I started passionately focused without stop, and also 54 just had so much success with the concerts, doing concerts that had feeling about the great theme in Sondheim that I was finding a lot. We disappear, we die, but we don't. Mm-hmm. Or care for the tale you tell, that is the spell. All these philosophical ideas that seem to have in them a kind of life and death wisdom, but empathic and loving. And I thought, God, people don't think of Sondheim as loving. So I thought, I'm going to make a loving record. I'm going to put love and Sondheim together, inward facing and lyrical. And I'm going to find 14, 15 songs, and I'm going to make them like a beautiful letter in a bottle that's going to float down a river. And it will be the letter I leave to my peers and to my kids, if I were to go. I mean, I wasn't actually like, you're really dying or anything, but you know, anytime you face your health, you know, like any midlife moment, anything where your skin looks funny, what's that black dot, you know, whatever, oh my God, I'm gonna die, you know, I mean, those natural instincts, you know, hit someone like me, you know, like ripples in the water. It's like one thing and then it ripples again, and then I see this concentric circles of emotion and seeking to contain those feelings somehow. So Sondheim was aware, and we worked on it together. We chose songs together. He made some suggestions like, Isn't He Something, which is a mother singing to her good son about how much she prefers the bad son. So it's actually like a darkly lyrical act of wisdom there, which is, you know, what the awful thing a mother could do. So anyhow, I made that album that was called Sondheim Sublime. I tortured a bit over the title because I wanted it to be Sondheim Sublime. Sublime is a cool word, and then I won't talk anymore about it. But sublime comes out of the history of art. And I was an art history total nerd at Yale, where I studied art history. And the sublime art movement in the 18th century in London, in England, mostly you think first of Turner. The idea of the sublime is where the beautiful meets terror. So the idea of beauty and terror meeting. So that was what I was doing. And I talked to Sondheim about the word sublime. Wordsworth has written about sublime. Sondheim was embarrassed by the word. I think he felt I was worshiping him or something. He told me he thought it was a camp word. And we had a million funny emails where I couldn't entirely enlist him, but I did it anyway. And he knows that I have my own mind. So it was just a great thing. It was like such a great project to work with him. I relied a lot on dreamy songs like I Remember and Children in Art and Move On and Things from Into the Woods and anything sexy. You're never gonna, I don't think I'll ever sing Buddy's Eyes unless I get paid a lot of money. It's too old lady-ish.
Right.
But I found, you know, what I thought was a sensual approach. And Ted Firth is a poet, piano. And I like funky things. So we got some funky guys to play a few funky things so that it would get trance-like at times, prayer-like, trance-like, meditative, reflective, even groovy. But again, it was inward-facing. And it was so beautifully received and understood. Really. And some of my concerts were like, not like religious, but like people were holding my hands after, crying.
Right.
You know, people were very touched that I'd seen Sondheim in that light. So I was really proud of it. I'm super proud of it. I love his music.
Well, and it's a wonderful part of your catalog because your catalog is so diverse, and Sondheim is has got such a wealth of material that can be interpreted by singers in different ways. And mining the Sondheim catalog and his is just a treasure trove of material. And so now you're revisiting it and your motivation.
No, I'm in a whole different mood.
It's a totally different motivation this time because you're coming at it from a totally different perspective. Sassy. And an angle. Yeah.
Exactly. My sassy midlife, you know, this is, you know, the film noir record was kind of a, you know, a sort of an erotic fantasy, like while the kids were in bed and my husband had COVID and I'm just in the middle of a pandemic and the whole world is going to shit. And I was thinking to myself, watching these movies, like out of the past and stuff, I was like, we're reliving or like the world. You can't trust any politicians. You can't trust anyone. You don't know who's who. The world is really dark. It was a world war, you know, that brought these German emigre, many Jewish people to Hollywood and making these Euro movies over there. It was just so interesting to me, you know, Jewish history of it was interesting. And also the Hollywood, low budget, you know, as we were all doing Zoom and stupid stuff, you know, with our computers to make art. Like that was kind of what noir was, with low budget movies with B actors. Mm-hmm. You know? And so I took noir and made it a mirror of now, and got new music made. And I put myself in a sort of crazy housewife mentality that I'm going into my computer, into my noir movies, and I'll come back later, you know, like mommy will come back later. Like my classmates are kind of like that. People laugh so hard. And I dress like Rita Hayworth, but they get the idea that I'm just this Bronxville mom, you know, just tripping out, like, to get out of the pandemic and do something more glamorous and sexy with her time than make dinner, clean with Clorox. So anyway, the film noir was like an event, you know, and when you'd come to the show, it was like an event. But then the pandemic's ending, and again, 54 Below asked me to be one of the first people back on stage, yeah, you know, like 2 years ago. And I thought, what would I sing about if we're really in a crisis? If people, you know, my health thing was good. I don't want to get all set, you know, soppy with Sondheim now and stuff and philosophical. I don't want to burden people like that. Or get them, you know, I just want to wind down. I want to wind up, you know? So I was thinking about Manhattan, and I thought, well, God, cause this is a New York nightclub is the pulse of New York City. It's like, get the subway running, get people to eat and get people singing in sexy clothes. So I was like, okay. So I made a concert called Melissa Sings Her New York. And it was all about Manhattan. Like, why the hell am I here at all, right? Why didn't I just go to the Hamptons or move to Montana like everybody else, you know? I didn't want to leave Manhattan. You know, I don't need New York. Who needs New York? Everybody's like, New York's not the center of the world. I'm like, yes, it is. So I start with Give Me Somebody to Dance For. And I just stand on the stage and I sing Donna McKechnie's thing. Donna came to the show. I had multiple encores, and I ended up with all these cool New Yorkers. That some of the Yankees came. Donna McKechnie came. Some of the Balanchine dancers came that I know. Who else? Joe Torre. Some fire commissioner came because I'd met him. Lots of tennis players, lots of business people, lots of people in the literary world. I did a thing about New York. Like, why do we come to New York?
Right.
And I just sang music that was about that ambition. And then another 100 people just got off of the train. My Long Island girl, I couldn't ever stop my teenage self wanting New York City. So I thought about that girl and I painted a picture of my career and love stories and Broken Heart and West Village and living uptown, downtown, decisions we make. And I read John Updike and I read Nora Ephron and I read E.B. White. I read clips by New York writers trying to make sense of the challenge and thrill of New York City. Mm-hmm. Ended up with a lot of Sondheim in it. He lived in New York within 20 blocks. He loved New York City. He wrote brilliantly about Manhattan people. He talked about New York people. He said he only likes neurotic New York people. He doesn't like other people. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, that's interesting. So I had a lot of him in it. And I thought about my family history from Italy, who came to Manhattan. They came to Manhattan to be artists. And they ended up, two of them, as showgirls. And one was really in the Ziegfeld Follies.
Right.
Right? I actually brought this picture, though, your readers. It's not a podcast. But right. How beautiful are these women?
Mm-hmm.
So the Follies and these articles, which again, your readers can't see, but this is the New York Times in the 20s. You see a waitress is glorified. So I thought to myself, all right, so the ambition of the train was them on the boat from Italy, right? And the Ziegfeld Follies. And I thought, well, let me look at Sondheim's Follies. So we had a lot of Follies songs in mind, though I only did one. So this thing got three encores. And then 2 weeks after it closed, Mr. Sondheim died. Mm-hmm. And I got like a eureka moment. I said, you know what? I wonder if I could overlap all those John Updike ideas, all the thoughts from Laura Nero and Nora Ephron about marriage. Mm-hmm. Nora talks about there's nothing harder, no place harder to be married than Manhattan. And she has funny, funny quotes, which I probably could find. But she, like, brilliant. And I just tied my ideas to a Sondheim set, and I explored that for a while, and that's how this record came. Here's a good one. This is John Updike. The true New Yorker secretly believes that people living anywhere else have to be, in some sense, kidding. I know you're in California, but
it's funny because I was just at, and it wasn't necessarily tied to the fact that I knew I was going to be talking to you today, but last night I was over at some friends and we were just sitting. I was the first time I'd actually been to their place, and we just sitting having wine and talking and chatting, and it was, and we were talking about some friends of theirs who are moving to the East Coast. They're not moving to New York. They're moving to Boston. And they were concerned about, oh, well, they're Californians. They'll never make it and they'll never be happy in living on the East Coast or Boston. And I said, I have friends who were born and raised in Southern California who moved to New York, and they ended up flourishing in New York, and they adapted, and they lived there for 20 plus years. And then it got us all on this topic of how much, even though these guys have never lived in New York, how much they love going to New York. New York is this magnet. Even if you never lived there. And one of them even said, I would like to try and live in New York for a year, just to see if I could live in New York for a year. It's this draw. It's this magnet for people.
Yeah. Well, that a big part of my record is, you know, there's kind of a shape to the album. And the first shape of it, I would call sort of the ecstatic arrival. Mm-hmm. Like we arrive ecstatic. You don't just come to New York. You arrive like with hope. Yes. Nobody comes to New York. Like, you don't just like slip in, right? You come with like a dream, some kind of an ecstasy. That's why I have the album begin with one of his unpublished songs called Dawn. And it's an amazing song about a new start. And it's the dawn of the day. And it's about New York at dawn, when it's neither night nor day. And it's clean and quiet, but a million people are dreaming. And there's a wondrous, subdued ecstasy in that song. It's just beautiful. And we got a very, very famous jazz trumpet player named Bruce Harris to overdub the sound, like not the, you know, it's like as if the army bugle call, but played by an poetic jazz artist. Mm-hmm. So you hear the waking up of this place. So it's the whole album, the first three songs, four songs are all that ecstatic. So Take Me to the World, Another 100 People Just Got Off the Train, and it's all super funky, you know.
Walking home from working late and around the bend, dawn. You may look grim, but you feel just great, 'cause you've got this friend, dawn. You're both halfway between yesterday and tomorrow. Not a street that doesn't have a shine, not a sound except the milkman's rattle, not a stream of 7 million cattle, and the city's mine, yours and mine. It's when the moon's gone down, but the sun not up just before this great big town becomes a great big buttercup. Your feet are sore, you're feeling weird, and then there it comes, dawn. The city's roar may have disappeared, but the city hums, dawn. Not a street that isn't clean and still, not a wall that doesn't gleam and glisten, not a roof that isn't gold and listen, not a single drill. What a thrill, dawn. You're all past four, you're half awake, and the town is dead. Yawn. You think, what more can a person take? And then overhead, dawn. Calm and quiet though the city seems, dead asleep it's still alive and teeming. What with 7 million people dreaming, 7 million dreams, of course it gleams. You watch the stars go one by one. You see the first sign of the sun. It makes you feel that done is done, and better things have just begun. It's called a
This is not like, oh, Melissa's taking cast music and just shoving it together. It's all music from his urban-inspired, urban-based shows and films. But then we applied it to this idea, this concept. So we wanted it to be funky and full of rhythm, because rhythm is the city, right?
Yes.
So the number one thing we need is the best drummer on earth. And my producer, who works for Sting and, huge pop stars and stuff, Rob Mathis, he's like kind of funky, works with like Stevie Wonder and things. He says to me, well, if we could just get some drummer like Lewis Nash. He's a legend. And then I don't know, somebody was like, why don't we just call Lewis Nash? Like, Lewis Nash has never heard of Sondheim, right? We got Lewis Nash to New York City for 3 days. Yeah, and he was just like, the way he played, like he was fine. Mm-hmm. Wanted funky. Another 100 people just got off of the train and came up to the ground. Like, it's so funky. You're not even believe your ears. This isn't like Broadway people being cool. This is like Lewis Nash playing the drum.
Right, right.
It's amazing. So we're so excited. So that arrival, like your friends, they'll be okay, but they got to watch their step.
Right. Well, and that's what New York is all about. It's a different kind of energy. And I like, what's nice about it is, I mean, talk about the process of finding the songs, because obviously you had found some of them for your show.
Well, so the themes and ideas, were actually had been planted and had been played with and had been sung and were successful with audiences. They were interested in it. I had ideas like about the arrivals. That was kind of developed that idea. But I also had ideas about harmony with people, like a Laura Nero story that she has written about New York. When she was a teenager, she said when she knew she loved New York was when she heard a doo-wop group in the subway, and she was standing at the top of the stairs, and she heard in her ear a harmony, and she went down the stairs and she added her harmony and harmonized with strangers. And she said, and they didn't ask me to leave. The idea of harmonizing with strangers. And I was like, that's a great idea. Right. So I just knew as well that I wanted this record to have like a band feeling, sort of a swinging big band, great jazz drumming, horns, strings. I wanted a community to be felt. So then I would start choosing music for that. My actual set list is probably not like completely fresh in my head, but let me look at it. So Dawn, another 100 people, Opening Doors, What More Do I Need? Again, it's youthful, also youthful because sometimes that's early work.
Right.
So also the Juvenalia being at the top of the set list is intentional, but exciting too. I have a window. I can't really see through it. So dirty. I see half a tree, but hey, I know that feeling. I was 21, to and My Fair Lady, you know. So I superimpose these songs and my energies and life and memories. There's a super posh word called a palimpsest, which is kind of a word that is appropriate. A palimpsest is like when you write on a piece of paper, but you writing over something else. And a palimpsest is when you can see the writing that was under as
right.
well. You see two things at once.
Right.
So if you can handle that slightly pretentious idea, I think you can see his work in my life.
Right. And that's one of the things I actually wrote down. I didn't use the fancy word, but I did write that on my notes.
I didn't know that word before this project. Somebody else said, this is like a palimpsest. And I was like, it is? Okay, what? But I do recommend people look it up because it could really be useful the way you see your life, you know?
So and that's what you did with this because I mean, as you said, New York was so ingrained in Sondheim's work because he was born and raised and lived his whole life basically central in New York. And your life has really been, and your family has been all about New York. You really have kind of overlaid your experience with your whole life in New York with Sondheim's. And you can see how it's like it's all interwoven with the songs and your experiences. And I can tell, because I know your history, I can see with the song choices how it works with your life.
Yeah. Well, Take Me to the World is the fourth song, and Take Me to the World is from Evening Primrose, you know, which is always a little bit still kind of fresh in our minds because of the pandemic and the idea of these people being isolated and trapped. I'm speaking like your listeners would know what mm-hmm. these things are. Evening Primrose, if for anyone doesn't know, is about people who get trapped in a
department store.
And kind of there's a little creepy group of mannequins that come to life. And it's sort of a subculture. It's just weird. It was Sondheim doing like he's doing with Here We Are, abstract work, you know, mm-hmm. surrealism, really. But so Take Me to the World. I love Take Me to the World. I do have a couple of reasons for loving it. Is that the thrill, of course, to first of all, I like the first sentence, take me to the world. He doesn't say that's so happy, everything's perfect. Let me see the world with clouds. He doesn't say in sunshine. So I love that Sondheim is saying, let me see the world with clouds. It's so brave, right? Mm-hmm. Right away, the first sentence is not simplistic and overly idealistic. Like his mentor, Oscar Hammerstein, might have said, oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day. God knows that if Sondheim were to write that, it would be, oh, what a beautiful morning at the end of a horrible night.
Right.
You know?
Right.
That would be his lyric, you know?
Right.
Oh, what a beautiful morning at the end of a awful day. Awful night, you know? Like, hungover, you know, like it would have to be. So even his optimistic songs, you know, have a twist in them. So Take Me to the World, I also though have teenage daughters, and though I don't proselytize or whatever that word means, I don't preach on Instagram about things that upset me, mostly because a lot of teenage girls follow me. Mm-hmm. I don't cry and moan about Ukraine and things, but I'm really upset about everything. But I don't, you know, stand in a soapbox. It's just not where I can, because I want this project safety, right, to teenage girls. All the community of my three teenage girls, there's a lot of them following me. So I think of a song like Take Me to the World as, do you want the world? Why then you shall have the world. Ask me for the world again. You shall have the world. Just hold my hand and know you're not alone.
Let me see the world with clouds. Take me to the world, out where I can push through crowds. Take me to the world, a world that smiles with streets instead of eyes, where where I can walk for miles with you. Take me to the world that's real. Show me how it's done. Teach me how to laugh, to feel. Move me to the sun. Just hold my hand whenever we arrive. Take me to the world where I can be alive. Do you want the world? Why then you shall have the world. Ask me for the world again. You shall have the world. A world of skies that's bursting with surprise to open up your eyes for joy. We shall see the world come true. We shall have the world. I won't be afraid with you. We shall have the world. You'll hold my hand and know you're not alone. We shall have the world to keep. Such a lovely world.
I want to sing it both for my own teenage girl self who came to New York, but also I sort of early on my record, I invite other young people to stay positive and to feel safe. You know, maybe that's more my role in the world, is to be idealistic. Not that I'm not aware, but just to be kind and exciting for young people to not be frightened. You know, so anyway, I have that early in the record. So that's how I chose that song. It's like me. It's this great theme. It's appropriately New York, urban. It's, and then there's these other layers, which I think will make it interesting to me for a long period of time and hopefully be, you know, and then track six, Can That Boy Foxtrot? Then we get into this Follies material, and that's just a dead on
right
tribute to Aunt Rose. Aunt Rose had five husbands. She used to smoke like a chimney. I remember the smell of smoke. And she always had red lipstick on. And this was her fox stole. I had audio visual.
Oh my God, you even have the stole. Was that really her stole?
Mm-hmm. So oh I God. Actually like brought a few props. I was thinking we were going to be on.
Yes, we're not on video, but Melissa yeah. brought props, people. She's putting on a whole show. It's wonderful.
Yeah, fox stole. And then God. Her, it's on Instagram. You can see it. And then you can see the leather gloves to the elbow. Oh, amazing. So she was no children. She had no kids. And she, you know, so she was a saucy girl. And there was a show at the Ziegfeld Theater, the theater that was torn down that inspired Sondheim. Mm-hmm. She performed on that stage. And she was upstairs at the late show. In that same building that was torn down, that his show is about, she was in the Midnight Frolic. The Midnight Frolic is a rare party that was thrown by the Ziegfeld girls where the girls took their clothes off. Mm-hmm. And the wealthier the patrons, the more money, the more came off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the kind of showgirl survivor and playful beauty in that time, you know, tribute with great wit, of course. There's nobody wittier than Sondheim. And so I also want you to have a good time listening to this thing. It's not like, you know, you're not in school.
Right.
But so anyway, so that I have that sexy song. So that's how I chose that. Anyone Can Whistle, I chose because it's a not traditional choice. It's not a literal city.
I want to stop you for a second because I want people to, if they get a chance, they've got to read your liner notes. Because your essay liner notes are just wondrous to read for this album. They really are. And they really show
why.
They
better win a Grammy.
They should be.
They really show
why you have become kind of a guest columnist for the New York Times. Because they really show, you talk about going to an open house for Sondheim's Manhattan residence when it was up for sale and wandering through the different rooms. And it's just, it talks about your inspiration for the album. And what you said about Anyone Can Whistle absolutely caught me. And I'm hoping that's what you're going to say, because it's what you said about New Yorkers and about the simple versus the complicated. And it was so true.
We all know these creative people, right, who are really good at one thing or many things. They're brilliant. And then how do I put this, you know, on another level, they're utterly helpless.
Right.
You know, they can do these amazing, bright things, brilliant things. They know things. But then there's this utterly helpless in ourself sometimes. It's a real New York phenomenon. I'd love that song. And then when we do it live, it's a place for Ted Firth to just improvise. And emotionally, we do it on every record. We have one where we just go to Jupiter. You know, we just don't come back. Like we did that with Bad and the Beautiful with Film Noir.
Oh, right.
Which was really meditative and so hard that Bill Evans had to play it as an instrumental on the Tony Bennett record because it was just baffling Tony to sing it. It's so hard to sing. Michael Feinstein does a beautiful version, but it's like one of those melodies that it takes you weeks to learn. And then Ted can do his crazy stuff. And then it's just a beautiful meditation. Anyone Can Whistle, not as hard to learn, but again, meditative and vulnerable and just trippy. So that live becomes, you know, a boundaryless jazzscape.
Anyone can whistle, that's what they say, easy. Anyone can whistle, any old day, easy. It's all so simple. Relax, let go, let fly. So someone tell me why can't I can dance a tango, I can read Greek easy. Can slay a dragon any old week easy. What's hard is simple. What's natural comes hard. Maybe could show me how to let go, lower my guard, learn to be free. Maybe if you whistle for me. so simple. Relax, let go, let fly. So someone tell me why can't I can dance a tango. I can read Greek easy. I can slay a dragon any old week easy. What's hard is simple. What's natural comes hard. Maybe you could show me how to let go. Lower my guard. Learn to be free. Maybe if you whistle for me.
Anyway, so I'm glad you like that.
Oh, I've always loved the song, but I thought the way that you interpreted it as a New York song and about New Yorkers was absolutely nailed it. Because I read that in the liner notes and went, that's exactly right. That is exactly what the song is about, and it's exactly how it applies to people in New York. Just living in New York is such a complex thing anyway. Sometimes there are so many things you have to be able to do that are difficult and can be puzzling to people who have never lived in a city like that, and yet sometimes the simplest little things they just can't handle.
Yeah, you know? I mean, exactly. Relationships too, and maybe sex, you know, trust, other things, just like,
it's amazing.
It's a hard town, you know. So we sort of take a turn there that the album gets maybe more conceptual for a second. And you think, oh, she's, you know, working through something. And then Everybody Says Don't is crystal clear to me why it's on the record, because everybody says that's a dedication to all the people who say, you know, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do that, you'll never publish, you are not ready. Just all the no.
Well, it's a city, especially if you're working in the entertainment biz in New York, it's a city full of rejections.
Oh yeah.
You have to have a hard shell to deal with all the rejections you're going to face when you live in New York.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, anyone can whistle it's also from that, is literally not New York, but it's imaginatively and mythically New York, you know. Mm-hmm. But so to me, that's a song that's like, it sits on an interesting ledge between enthusiasm and like anger.
Mm-hmm.
Anger, you know. So in one way, is an anger for all the people who get in our way.
Right. You know, exactly.
Gatekeepers kind of thing, you know, who prevent us from expressing ourselves. The idiots and fools, really.
You know?
Can't do this. It's not possible. You can't make a record. You can't write a song, you know. But anyway, at the same time, like, this is my, you know, thing is, like, at the same time, I feel like there's something ecstatic about it, you know. It's like there's something enchanting and ecstatic because he's saying I do, right? Mm-hmm, that's mm-hmm. exciting vision. It's like the Sondheim vision of like, yeah, that butt,
right?
But
the fact that people tell you don't is what energizes you.
Well, it can, right?
Right.
Yeah, and it can also make you contentious and dark. But I don't know, maybe in a sense it's like Steve psychoanalyst, you know, wrote it. Because you know, or Oscar Hammerstein and his psychoanalyst collaborated on this.
Right, right.
I don't know. So when I sing it, though, I believe what I'm saying and I feel better at the end of singing it.
Mm-hmm.
I always feel better after I've sung the song. Like, so it's an advice song for me.
Right. And you and I always get the impression, because I know from having talked to you about the Out of the Dark album, that oftentimes for you, it's also when you perform these songs and you select these songs, you slip into a character when you sing the songs. And sometimes as I listen to this album, I envisioned these as different characters in the world of Sondheim. They're almost like different Sondheim leading ladies or different Sondheim women.
Yeah, Sondheim women. It's like a composite of like
a composite of
different women.
Yeah, different New York women.
Good, dreamers, yeah. Artists. I had a photographer, this really eccentric, brilliant photographer named Marco Vacchi, and he's from Italy, and he runs coffee bars and a wine bar in the West Village, which I didn't know. And I called my most famous friend, who I figured would know photographers. I called Alec Baldwin and I said, I need to get like, I want to get like, you know, something kind of Hollywood for this. Cause I have this idea. It's like a movie, the Sondheim woman. Like, I just want to make sure it doesn't look like headshots or stupid. I want it to be interesting. And he was like, oh, I know the photographer. And then, so I meet this guy, Marco Vacchi, but had already agreed to do the shoot. So I arrive at his house and he has a mustache bigger than Salvador Dali. Literally this whole thing like goes out past like the mid cheek, like, and just twirls. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not putting him down for that. He's amazing, but it's a role of character. He's a look, you know? And I said, Marco, I had already told him, I want to find a character. This is like, it's not really the plays. It's like, and it's not really me. It's this woman, this New York woman, and she's going to have different facets. She'll have a turtleneck. She'll be moody. She'll be nervous. She'll be on the phone. She'll be sexed out of her head. She'll be hungry for something. Hungry, bruised, something. He was just like, oh, Melissa is wonderful. He loved it. You know, he was like, that's Italian. You know, like, you could just say anything to him. So we did a lot of pictures. So those are going to be even more on the vinyl. We are putting like a whole spread. But if you buy the CD, you get a lot of his work and you'll see these super crazy pictures. You know, there's a few that are undressed that haven't come out yet. But I'm climbing on the Alice statue in a top hat, Alice in Wonderland. There's the turtleneck pictures. There's a whole bunch of things. So we were exploring this. By the way, this is not like I had this idea all in a day. It all unfolds. So as I got, oh, I have to take pictures. Well, what would the pictures be?
Mm-hmm.
Pictures be just Melissa looking healthy or, I don't know, in a jacket. And I'm like, no, let's make it be like Sondheim just didn't get to write these women yet. Like, what would, so I had a beret in one picture and I look like a maybe irritable woman who runs a art gallery, you know, in a beret and a vest and, you know, a little have a chip on her shoulder. Just characters that he didn't get to, you know. I don't know what I'm saying. But
no,
you know,
but it makes sense because the songs are all, I mean, that's the thing about Sondheim is the songs are very character driven. They're all very specific to characters. And
so this is like Carrie Bradshaw. Like think of it like, you know, she's a writer. So that way she can have all these different moods. You know, it's like a middle-aged Carrie Bradshaw in my own Sondheim in the city.
Well, sort of. I mean, as I listened to it, I was sort of like, I can see Melissa sort of immersing herself in all these different Sondheim women as she's doing.
Did you see the movie that we made?
No, I haven't watched it yet. I saw some stuff posted, but I haven't seen it yet.
Oh my God. You have to go watch it because this is literally the culmination of what are we on? Song. There's a good thing. We're on song 8 in our little chat. It's good thing going is from Merrily We Roll Along, the New York show. And it alludes to a relationship where one person is, you know, obviously more ambitious for the relationship than another. And the other, you know, and so I was thinking, well, what could I do for a music video? The head of the label, super great guy, Sean Flavin, that's how you say his name. He is amazing. And he's like, it has to be Good Thing Going. I love that song. I said, okay, so that's my single, right? And that, we work in a world where anybody
that's singles anymore, but right.
It's like the five people who care.
Right.
So we have our single. Thank you for those five people. And I hope you're here. So Sean was like, that has to be that song. And then I was thinking, okay, so a relationship song, a good thing going, going, gone. So what's, you know, and then I started looking at Woody Allen's movies and a little bit of new wave cinema, but I realized that Annie Hall was a cabaret singer.
Right.
And she had a good thing going and doesn't work out. And I was thinking, okay, so he's a writer, but I got free locations and I got the Irish Repertory Theater so that I could have the location for a couple hours. So I said, okay, so it has to be set at either Birdland. I'll do my singing at Birdland. And then the plot will have to be a director and an actress instead of a writer and a... Mm-hmm. You know, so we did all these scenes at the Irish Rep. You have to go and see it.
I'll have to watch it.
It's a story. So we made a movie.
I'll put a link on the webpage.
Oh, you must. People love it. And the crazy thing is we did it in 5 hours out of the back of my car. And Billboard magazine came to my concerts at Birdland and I met the editor-in-chief. And I said, oh, hi, you know, he's young. And he was like very impressed and really happy. And I said, I love Sondheim. And I said, you know, I made a movie. And he said, you did? I said, yeah, I made a movie out of my car. And it's edited. He goes, can I see the movie? And I said, it's a mini Annie Hall. And it's really emotional. I weep in it. I'm undressed in one moment. I'm completely at the Washington Square Park where we recreated all these two shots at the bridge, you know, Brooklyn, just like Annie Hall. And we just made a love story in 4 minutes. I'm not like undressed, but I am kind of. But so I said, we did a love story about it. And the girl's crushed when it's over. And he's like, can I see this movie? So overnight, he watched the movie. He did a Billboard exclusive a couple of days ago.
Oh, wow.
Said, yeah, I know. Like, this is the guy who did the movie, Matthew. I was like, Matthew, it's a hit. He's like, Melissa, I can't believe it. he's a dad at the ballet school. My daughter's ballet school. I said, Matthew, we're a hit. He's like, we're a hit. I can't believe this.
Well, you'll have to submit it for a short film.
Oh, stop. Seriously?
Well, you could. It's, you know, you can put it in the festival circuit. You can.
Yes, we could.
It's That's 4 minutes. I mean, it's less than, it's a short, isn't it considered?
You check it out. You tell me. You're the Hollywood guy.
It's considered a short film.
Stop. Yeah. You're my only Hollywood friend. So, and all your friends there. So you get all your friends looking at it. Let me know. But it is made beautifully and full of allusions to A Man and a Woman, which is a new wave. You'll see me in the window and Moody and all that. And very, very clearly tips its hat to Annie Hall, which Billboard magazine picked up on. And even down to the thing where she lifts up the bra and goes, I could never wear this. Like like a sexy thing. And she's laughing. Like we do all these little homages. So anyway, so we have already made our first little exploration into fiction.
It started out like a song. We started quiet and slow with no surprise. And then one morning I woke to realize we had a good thing going. It's not that nothing went wrong. Some angry moments, of course, but just a few. And only moments, no more, because we knew we had this good thing going. I wanted too much. Was that such a mistake at the time? You never wanted enough. All right, tough. I don't make that a crime. While it's going along, you take for granted some love will wear away. We took for granted a lot, but still I say it could have kept on growing instead of just kept on. While it's going along, you take for granted some love will wear away. We took for granted a lot, but still I say it could have kept on growing instead of just kept on.
Goes on from there. Broadway Baby, another, and Uptown Downtown. That's more Follies. Uptown Downtown, you know, is great yes, song.
I love that song.
Yeah, anybody could quit wanting to be a lyricist after they hear that.
I know. I love that song. I mean, I understand why it was cut or replaced, I should say, in Follies. Mm-hmm. But I still love that song.
No, I love it.
I think it's still one of the best.
Yeah, because we have to decide, you know, when your friends, if they don't stay in Boston, if they move to New York, your first question is, you're going to live uptown or downtown?
Right. And it really does capture the differences.
It does. And what's the sort of, you know, history that's interesting is that downtown, in songwriters have always used downtown to symbolize where the artists are or the avant-garde are. And downtown keeps changing because when I was down, downtown was Soho, but my ancestors, it would have been Gramercy Park, where National Arts Club is still from the 1800s. And then it became Tribeca and now it's Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
But Park Avenue, always Park Avenue.
Yes. So that will not change. I don't think. No. I don't think that will change.
And then the album takes a turn for Heartbreak. I Think It Wasn't Meant to Happen, which is cut from Follies, is the Send in the Clowns of his oeuvre that is hard to sing. It's like the impossible 2.5-octave song. That's basically the same song as Send in the Clowns because it's about regret.
Mm-hmm.
And not a showgirl. She was an actress. And she's processing that she's... like Send in the Clowns. She's in denial. Mm-hmm. Send in the clowns. I'll be fine. Thank you very much. Send in the clowns, but I'm dying. And in the same way, she says, well, it wasn't meant to happen.
Right.
I'll be good. But she's not good at all. So it's a wonderful study of Send in the Clowns at the same time as a fantastic song.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. So that is a ballad that I hope people will be like, what?
Mm-hmm.
It's a good one. Then I have two songs about marriage. Little Things You Do Together and Sorry Grateful. Now here I have something to charm you because I found my notes from my concerts, which I'm going to do some more concerts. But then I'm also doing one other thing, which is on Sondheim's birthday at the Green Room. I'm going to do I'm going to do something odd. It's going to be storytelling night. It's not going to have the band. It's not going to have Ted. And I'm going to read. I'm going to tell the story of the Sondheim woman. And I'm going to read sections of like literature as well as something I'm going to write. So it's going to have like a storytelling New York. It should be like a sexy John Updike short story. Mm-hmm. And with a lover and all this stuff. And I will stitch 6 or 7 songs together. And I'm going to do it with just a guitar player. So I think it's going to be a little blue jeans and a blouse. Like I think it's like Sondheim and a bong. It's like Sondheim. Okay. I think it's going to have that sort of John Updike 70s movie, or a book. John Updike was a great writer. So I'm just going to try a storytelling night where I explore a little bit of interplay between sort of a 70s writing style storytelling and Sondheim. It actually is it's era appropriate. Mm-hmm. But I'm still writing this, so I don't have that totally clear in my head. But I did a lot of reading in my New York concert. But here's a fun one. This is from Nora Ephron. Marriage isn't easy anywhere, but don't you think it's especially hard in New York? She goes on about marriage in Manhattan. She says, the desire to get married is a basic and primal instinct in New York women. It is followed by another basic and primal instinct, the desire to be single again. Which Nora added, I would never want to be married to a man I wouldn't be proud to be divorced from.
Yes, that's very Nora Ephron.
Very Nora Ephron. So that goes nicely into, sorry, grateful, and the little things you do together. And then you have being alive, that's the record. And there's another song, actually. There's another coda that didn't get onto the album that's going to come out like later in the year.
Okay.
That was like something was brought to me through a secret tunnel, an early song of Sondheim's called Nice Town, But, which is just from a demo of Steve when he was a teenager. And it was key and really super crazy. It was under a minute and 10. And it's a song that says, nice town, but I wouldn't want to live there. Nice town, but the maddening pace is too much for me. Canyons of stone and steel. Sorry, but that's the way I feel. It's a nice town, but there's nowhere near enough give here. It's all take here. It would degrade me. I wouldn't live here if you paid me. If you gave it to me for a song, here's where I belong. So it's like a really wacky little song. So that's how the CD was meant to end, but it's not even copyrighted music. So we're working on it.
Cool. That'll be fun.
It will be fun. But so, yeah, we have Being Alive currently as our final, mature version, I guess, of that. Yeah. Great song.
And I highly recommend people check out the album, because Sondheim in the City is, and I think I told you this before we started recording. I'm always, always impressed with your albums, because as I said, there is so much of your heart and thought that goes into every single project you do. I mean, I'm serious. Every album that you put out, I know, is such a treat, because there's always so much behind it, which really makes a difference. And it comes through when you listen to it. And before we started, I said to Melissa, I said, I think this is probably your most accomplished and complex album in some ways, because the sound is so different. It's got the kind of jazzy big band sound, which your other
albums. It's expensive. I mean, this is a really expensive record too. Like, so this is a real production. This is as big of an album as I really think you can make. We had an orchestra, a swing band. It took years to save money to do it. And then we have the wonderful support of Concord. So but I'm so appreciative. Thank you. Theater life is a theater life. And then I got these songs in my life and this relationship. Sondheim was, I wouldn't say a personal friend, but he wrote to me a lot. Oh, can I read you one of his emails?
Sure.
This is from 2018, because we share a birthday, but just a day apart. I wrote to him, happy birthday to us. And it was 2018. He writes back, happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Melissa. Happy birthday to you. And there's an asterisk. And at the bottom, the asterisk repeats. It says, music and lyrics, copyright, Stephen Sondheim. Piles of these. But Well, but he was a protective force, and he was encouraging. And
right. Well, and that's one of the things that was, I mean, obviously, I think one of the best things that happened after he passed was the fact that people began sharing online their correspondence. And that was always so wonderful to read the correspondence he had with so many different people and just the little notes he would send to people. And it was so wonderful to read how supportive, because a lot of people, I don't think, realized that how supportive and mentoring like he was for so many people. And just even just fans who would send him stuff, he would send things back and he would write people back just little notes. And they were always, he was always open.
Be mindful, that was an evolution. That wasn't always the way.
Right, right.
It wasn't always the way. So people who really knew him were also, there was a few people who I know were absolutely wrecked by him.
Yeah.
It was an evolution for him, and we should all allow ourselves an evolution, you know. And that's why I say sing being alive, because I think being alive is about renewal,
right?
You know, so we have to let him be remembered that way. But there are plenty of people who are just not going to do that.
Yeah.
You know, people who think I have him on a pedestal and I should wake up a little.
Oh, everybody has their faults, and everybody people evolve over time. They really do.
Yes. And then that's, and I think to do that. Right.
Right. And I think you made a comment about that in your liner notes with just how different he was when he met his partner and things, he was a different person in a lot of ways.
Right. You know? For me, this is the beginning of the assessing the long haul of life.
You know,
this record is fun and sexy, and I'm going to get out there and swing it with these jazzy guys, and we just have the most fun. But what gives it its thunder and what gives it its energy is truth.
Yes.
No, truth and optimism, you know, that we can all change and all survive. And there's no winning. He's gone.
Right.
He wins everything, but we don't stay.
Right.
So we disappear, we die, but we don't, you know? So right. Like, it's just, I guess, you know, we all have to find our way to make sense of human life. And I know it sounds crazy, but I love Michel Legrand. Like, he's super fun, like, and sexy. And I always love singing in French, and I love French people, and I love my trips to France. And actually, I think there's a lot of healing in Legrand's music, but the ideas and the words, the wit, like it never ever ends with Sondheim. You're always like, oh, that's so funny. Oh, I couldn't have that. It's like, it's always fun to do, you know, cause it's never easy. So anyway, long live Mr. Sondheim and all his devotees like you.
Well, you know? Melissa, thank you so much.
You LA. Thank you. So I'm going to see you next time. I'm going to take you to a lunch or something.
Okay. Next time you're out here, you please let me know. We will definitely coordinate schedules so that we can get together and see each other. But again, congratulations on another terrific album. People, get out there, purchase a CD, please. Sondheim in the City, and the vinyl is coming soon. So
yeah, May 7th.
May 7th, you can get
May 7th. We'll have a beautiful vinyl, and these are very precious days. And super appreciate your support. I really do. Thank you for having me.
Now this is the tale of a dame known as Harriet, who climbed to the top of the heap from the bottom. A beautiful life was her aim, and to vary it, she wanted the sun and the moon, and she got 'em. She isn't the least exhausted from her climb, but she does look back from time to time. And the subject of this evening's quiz is who she was and who she is. She's stepping out with a swell. Downtown, she's holding hands on the L. Hyphenated Harriet, the nouveau from New Rochelle. town. She's got the Vanderbilt class. Downtown, she's with the sidewalk Cezanne. Hyphenated Harriet, the nouveau from New Rochelle. She sits at the Ritz with her splits of mums and starts to pine for a stein with her village chums. But with a Schlitz in her mitts down in Fitzroy's bar, she thinks of the Ritz, so it's so schizo. Uptown, it's Harry Winston she needs. Down, it's strictly zircons and beans. Ask her, should she be uptown or down? She's two of the most miserable girls in town. Her village chums, but with a Schlitz in her mitts down in Fitzroy's bar, she thinks of the Ritz, oh, it's so schizo. Uptown, it's Harry Winston she needs. Downtown, it's strictly zircons and beads. Should she be uptown or down? She's two of the most miserable girls. She's two of the most miserable girls.